Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of the Chain Gang podcast. Today I am joined by a very special guest, one of the most iconic voices of cycling, former national champion, Brian Smith. How are you?
I'm good. I don't know about special, but yeah, you know, it's a pleasure to be part of any podcast these days during the lockdown.
Yeah, it's something to do, at least. That's what I found anyway. So obviously, talking of that, this week we would have had Flesh One on yesterday, and it would have been Liège Bastogne on Liège on the weekend. Were they races you look forward to in the year particularly?
Very much so. When I started cycling, I thought I was a bit more of a sprinter than anything else. And then I moved to France to ride for ACBB, and I learned soon that I wasn't a real sprinter. I was more like a punchy rider. And then I became good at going up short climbs. Anything under 5 kilometres was perfect for me. Anything over that, I used to struggle. So with my kind of power to weight ratio, I became a punchier rider. And the climbs of, you know, Flesh and Liège in that area kind of really suited me. And every time I went to that part of the world, I always really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and obviously the atmosphere there is pretty incredible for all the races in that whole region. When you commentate, do you go over there or do you commentate from a studio in the UK?
Do you know what? In the past, a lot of the times we used to commentate on site. That's the only way they were able to do it. But with technology nowadays, it's developing all the time. And in fact, I just got a phone call earlier on today that, you know, we could be doing more and more remote commentary. I know that our friends from Germany, Eurosport, they commentate and they're not in the same country when they're commentating. They've got a bespoke homemade box at home they kind of dial into. So I think as technology gets better and better, you know, Wi-Fi, you know, 5G, all that sort of stuff gets better, you'll see a lot of remote stuff. I still think I like to go to events. I like to go to the tour. You get a taste of the atmosphere. Last year, Eurosport decided to do the Giro d'Italia from the studio. And the previous 2 years, I went there with Jonathan Edwards. So we set up a new team with Bradley Wiggins, Orla Shinawi, and various kind of guests as they came in. And I thought we may have lost a bit more of the atmosphere and what was happening. But I think technically, we could deliver a lot more. We saw a lot more because, you know, we had the big screens. We had the commentary coming in. We never really missed anything. When you're on site, it's sometimes very difficult because you've got a small monitor and everybody's trying to crowd around to see what it is. And then you've got to go and get your lunch and do other things. And you kind of miss bits. I think in the Vuelta last year when we were on site, we went for lunch and all of a sudden it kicked off with, you know, Movistar, you know, riding in the crosswinds and Roglic crashing, and we missed it. And Bradley got a call to come to Eurosport International to do something on it. And I went up to go as well from the table, and I got asked, why are you going? I said, because I want to see it, because that's the only time you're going to be able to see it on the replays, because my job as a pundit afterwards is to answer questions. And that was a big controversial part of the race. And if I didn't see it, then I'm not going to see any replays. So I needed to see it. And that's the thing I found, that I love being at the races, but actually you can see a lot more from, you know, not being there and doing it from studio.
And also obviously the thing with being in the studio is Eurosport, I don't know, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, they don't tend to be the host broadcaster. So they don't actually have control over what you do see. So being in a studio, you're left with what the host broadcaster do, what you see, like Sportster or Sweet Spot.
It's the same. Like you say, the host broadcaster, the producer of that, we get the pictures. Very rarely do you get a whole broadcaster that is got its own feed. I think the only time that I've seen that is in Tour of California, where you've got Versus. And Versus were the host broadcaster, and they had their own commentary, their own feeds for Phil and Paul. And we had just they call it the dirty feed, just the normal feed coming down the line. But nowadays, the host broadcaster, he puts out the pictures that we see. Like you say, we don't have an indication or what they're going to be shown. So it's down to the producer of the host broadcaster. We just have to paint the picture and talk about it. And you'll hear us in the commentary box saying, when they're looking at the back of the bunch when the race is on at the front, and you'll hear us getting frustrated saying, I wish they'd go back to the front and see the real action. Well, this is someone that's pretty much controls everything from an OB truck. And you really have to understand cycling, and you really have to be on it to determine, of all the pictures in front of you, because I don't know if you've been in an OB truck, there are so many screens, so many cameras, that you have to choose which camera that you're going to put out on that feed. And sometimes they miss things, and that's why you see sometimes they go back and show something that they may have missed.
Yeah, and obviously, the one that stands out for me with doing this in particular is the Tour de France. But quite often the host broadcaster tend to have a distinct favouritism towards local riders. So quite often in the Tour de France, they'll be more focused on a breakaway up the road with the French rider in than what's actually going on in the chase to do with the GC. So I guess that's another struggle you have to battle with.
Look, everybody favours their own. I think here in Britain, the Tour of Britain, I think Sweet Spot do a very good job. There's no favouritism. I think show favouritism when I commentate towards the British riders. I commentate who I see, but you're right. In a lot of the national tours, they concentrate on their own riders. I've done a lot of tours. For instance, the Tour of Croatia. We did that just last year on site, and they will concentrate on some of the local riders, which I think is good, because if you've got a small tour and you know one of the riders is local, why not? Why not talk about that local rider and give that rider a bit of kudos and things like that? So I think it's important. It's important to paint the picture. It's important to get the action first and foremost. Okay, the beauty shots have to go in, because at the end of the day, a lot of these countries are trying to kind of paint the picture for tourism. And I think different things, and it helps us. If we are seeing the top guys all the time and you know, Sagan and Cavendish and all these Froome and these guys, we want to see some of the other riders, maybe the local riders, the smaller riders. And I think that's really, really nice. And, you know, the Tour of Britain, and first and foremost, because I worked on that quite a few years, they used to listen to our commentary. So, and the motorbikes cameramen, when they were listening to our commentary, they were actually, if we were talking about a certain rider, they would try and pick him out in a bunch, which I think helps, but they can't do it for a big international race because they cannot listen to all the streams, you know, the German stream, the Dutch stream, the French stream. They can't listen to everybody. But a lot of the times when we go on, they'll listen to possibly the host broadcast, the person that's sitting there talking about the race that, you know, they've contracted to be able to do that. Because that person sitting in the commentary box, when he's talking about things, it's nice that they can then go and show that. And, you know, it's good that the motorbike guys are actually listening.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's the advantage as well, because this year at the Tour, you obviously had Bradley and Alberto Contador on the bikes for the stages, which is, I assume, Eurosport's own bike that's just for Eurosport. And then, so that gives you at least a chance to have some sort of control. I mean, Bradley took it into his own to make it quite the spectacle while he was out there. But is that something that you find advantageous to have?
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. Normally, Eurosport can't intervene with the pictures. They can't put anything. All the graphics, everything that comes in comes from ASO. But luckily, they did a deal with ASO, which they could put, you know, Bradley on the bike. And when we started doing the bike stuff with it being in English, we didn't really know if the other countries were going to take it, but the other countries did take it, just like we saw Contador. We had Juan Antonio as well, did it, I think, for a couple of days. And I think Bradley found his niche. It's very difficult. I've done it myself when I retired from sports, and finding something that you're motivated by. And there's no better way. And I would love to be able to do what Bradley does. And on the motorbike in a bunch, because that's where I was motivated the most. I miss being part of that. I'm 52 now, I'm too old. I can't be part of, you know, a grand tour and keep up with these youngsters nowadays. So Bradley having retired, he's gone through, I think, a very difficult period over the last few years, but now he's found something that is motivating. I asked the same question to Lance Armstrong when he first retired. I said, how are you going to substitute what you get from cycling in normal life? And I think he struggled with that. His answer was, yeah, standing up in front of thousands and thousands of people promoting Livestrong. I don't think you get the same buzz, because I've done quite a bit of kind of guest speaking. I've spoken to 4,000 people in the past before. You don't get the same buzz. And I think what Bradley's seen now is he's done it. He's drifted around trying to find out. He's tried rowing. He's tried this. All these athletes that are retiring, they try to find the buzz, and the opportunity came up, and it was kind of Bradley's idea. He saw me getting interviewed by Alan Piper on a tour of Britain in 1994 when I crashed and I had a tourniquet in my arm. And he brought up the video when we were talking on his phone. And I'm like, well, he's really done some homework. He's really, really interested in this. And he said he wanted to be that person. He wanted to be that person that was right involved in the action. Look, he doesn't have to pedal anymore, but he's involved with it and he gets that buzz. Not everybody can do that. And I don't think Alberto Contador had that kind of personality that Brad had. But all three of the riders that Eurosport used last year got a major buzz from it. And I know I would have, and I know a lot of pro bike riders or ex-pro bike riders would love to get involved in the action.
Yeah, and obviously, thinking about Alberto Contador as well, I remember, I don't know if it was 2 years ago or so, when you have your little segment with the screen, Alberto does that for the Spanish Eurosport, doesn't he? And then sometimes the Eurosport use the Spanish one. How does that work?
I've been at, I wouldn't say it's my baby, but I got asked just over 3 years ago. There was a couple of roles coming up with the Eurosport, and there's a guy came from Sky called Doug Ferguson, and he became, you know, the production manager of the team on site. And I sat down with him, and he said, we need someone to do this, this, and this, and this, this, and this. And I said, I can do anything. I'm very versatile what I can do. So we thought that it was probably better for me to be the analyst. And then Matt Stevens became the journalist, which I think Matt has found his niche. Matt does a lot of different things, but I think what he's honed his experience in life into what he does in cycling, whether he's important. He's got a great personality. He knows the riders, and he can get right involved with it and, you know, ask the right questions, which I think is brilliant. With me, I love analysing things, and it kind of, the coach job kind of moulded me into that. I can overanalyse. I used to do that as a rider, and I used to love it. Every time, I can remember a lot of the times coming home after I'd been at a race, and I'd analysed that why I had lost or why I'd won, and I'd come back to my dad's, and my dad would say to me, so what happened? And I would have to go through it all again. And I kind of get sick of it because I'd already done it, and I was doing it myself. And I found I was doing it in races as well, which sometimes I lost because I was overanalyzing. So we did these things to camera. And I think the French who look after Eurosport in general across the countries, they saw what I was doing. They liked what I was doing. And of course, they got Juan Antonio to do it, and then they got Alberto to do it. But with Alberto, you really have to have experience about doing these things beforehand, because some of the times it's nice to rehearse. It's nice to go up there and do your 3-minute piece and rehearse. Okay, right, we'll go back and do that again. What I loved was the buzz of doing it live. Throw to me live, I'll do it live. And Alberto was having to do the Contador bits to Cameron. He was doing it live, but what he wasn't doing, I don't know if you remember, they started to introduce a pad because I wanted to have control of what was shown. I would pick the pieces out and show and stop it and do these things and then start drawing things on it. A lot of this pad stuff costs money. And we were kind of looking at the Sky Pad, but the Sky Pad is probably about £150,000. We didn't have that budget. We'd probably a tenth of that budget. So we had this pad, and technology doesn't always work. So with Alberto, he's got a bit of a personality. I wouldn't say he's as big as Bradley Wiggins, but they had to put the stuff up that all he had to do was just talk, because most of us guys are not multitasked, we're monotasked. And to talk and to watch what's happening on the screen and to use an iPad, that's very difficult. And all the time you're thinking, you have got 2 minutes or 3 minutes, and you're getting a chat from the producer in your ear. So there's a lot of things happening. A lot of people think that commentators just sit there and talk about the race and nothing else. Well, you could have two different conversations in your ear. So what I'm saying is, Contador done it the first time, and everybody looked at me. You got to remember, I've been commentating for 14 years. I've been used to this sort of stuff. Contador is new. Juan Antonio's doing it a bit longer. But when you're in a studio atmosphere doing a bit to camera, and you've got people talking in your ears, and you've got points to hit, and then they're saying, right, what's coming up next is the map, or what's coming up is a clip of this. That's not easy to do. And it's taken me years to be able to do that. And so when I did my coach pieces, a lot of the stuff that I did in the past in the media, I had been trained to do that. So when they thought that they'll get Contador to do it, they'll get Le Mans to do that, they'll get Juan Antonio to do that, they found it wasn't as easy as they think. The one person I think is nailed and he's getting better at it, and we've talked about it before, to do these bits to camera on a motorbike, talk to riders, have a sign-off, create something very unique, I think Brad has done it perfectly without the training. But you got to remember, Brad, he analyses a lot of things. He watches a lot of television, picks up a lot of details, and he works hard. And I think that was shown in the tour last year.
Yeah, and obviously one thing I noticed is while you were doing analysis and actually while you were commentating, you also picked up roles with MTN, who then became Dimension Data, and obviously started at Endura, which then became NetApp Endura. And I can see the MTN KOM jersey behind you. How transferable are the skills between those two, and how do you balance that? Because you were an interim general manager at a few of those teams, weren't you?
Yeah. I am quite proud of myself. I'm not biased. I say what I see, and I keep it very, very simple. So although I've got a hat on of maybe general manager of a certain team, and that team's in the race, I tend not to get carried away. I can remember when I was commentating, because a lot of the races I commentated on when Endura were racing, and then Endura became NetApp Endura. And one of the big races I commentated on was the Vuelta when NetApp Endura were riding. And I was personally looking after Leopold Koenig. And Leopold Koenig was attacking to try and win the stage. And Carlton Kirby, who was working with me, he was looking at me, getting all excited. He was getting more excited than me, because he knew that Leo was, you know, I was supporting him, I was helping him, and I was also kind of part of the team. But I pride myself in being neutral. And I can remember talking to, with Dimension Data, we're doing the Dubai tour, and I analysed the sprint at the end and said that Team Dimension Data, Mark, they totally messed it up. And I was on a phone call with Rolf Aldag, and Rolf said, Cav didn't really like your comments on the TV. You know, you got to realize that you're the general manager of this team, and you know, you're talking about these things, and we're trying to kind of motivate them. And I said, well, at the end of the day, I have to do my job. I have to speak honest, and sometimes the truth hurts. It's hard. And sometimes if I criticise Team Sky in the past, I'll get a text message from Dave Brailsford. Oh, that's not particular. The truth hurts, and that's what I have to do. I have to tell exactly as I... This is my opinion. I have to tell it as it is. But do you know what? If I was racing and I did something wrong, and a friend of mine, and same with commentary, I get close friends that say to me, oh, maybe you shouldn't have said that, maybe you should have said this, and you're saying this too much. I love constructive criticism because constructive criticism makes me better. And I think all riders, all managers, everybody needs a bit of constructive criticism and a different of opinion, because you can get lost in your own world. And sometimes the truth does hurt, but it makes you a better person if you can get out the other side of it.
Yeah, and some of these things that you have to balance, obviously, what with looking after riders and commentating, obviously, take a fair amount of work in the commentary box. Who do you think is best to work with in the commentary box, if you're allowed to say that? I don't know, don't want to cause any friction, but are there any commentators that you particularly like to work with? Because obviously, personally, as a viewer, I think my absolute favourite lead commentator on Eurosport has always been Rob Hatch, just because of how insightful he is and the languages he speaks and the amount he takes in.
I would say that I don't think there's one particular commentator, and there's another thing I pride myself in. When you go into that box, you are a team. I'm used to being a team player. I've been a team player all my life in cycling, and you know, when you go into that box, you're a pairing. And sometimes if the commentator says something you don't like and you react to it, it doesn't make for good viewing or good sound. There's two commentators, you mentioned one of them that I love working with, both I think equally the same and both very different. Carlton Kirby, for me, he cracks me up. We have a great time. He is Mr. Entertainer. Well, I'm Mr. Boring, Analyze, Tell It As It Is sort of thing. And there's a great combination between both of us. And I think between both of us, no matter what, if it's downtime for 2 hours in a Tour de France stage, Carlton's your man, right? If it's a big finish at the end, Carlton's your man, right? But there are maybe certain things about cycling that he relies on me, you know, the tactics and what's happening. But I think the dynamic is who you're sitting with. It's easier to commentate with someone you get on well with outside of the commentary box. But then I can say that about cycling. I've worked in teams where you don't particularly maybe like the person that you're trying to help, but you have to do your job. And that's what you have to do. And even with team building, I've had conversations with Mark Cavendish in the past when I said, you got to remember, come July, they'll be riding for you. I don't want them to do their job. I want them to do their job plus more. And that's where you come in, because you have to get really close to them and help them and support them in the early part of the season, so they'll help you in July. And sometimes it takes a while. Well, with Rob Hatch, he is younger. He's always improving. And I think from when I first started to commentate with Rob, he's come a long way. He's come a long way. And like you say, he's got different languages, pronunciations. He brings a different thing to the commentary box. Of course, he can't sit there for 2 hours and talk about experience because he's still young, but that'll come. And I think both times, because I think during the Eurosport's Tour de France coverage or Giro coverage or whatever coverage they were doing, they were tending to pair me off with Carlton Kirby and Sean Kelly with Rob Hatch. And I said, well, why can't we mix it up a little bit? Because I like a bit of variety. I like working with Rob. I like working with Carlton, but they're both very different styles.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously you mentioned Sean Kelly there, Mr. Perry-Niess. I don't know how often you get to work with him. Well, one thing I've noticed, I actually have got a video on my phone from, must have been the Tour de France 2 years ago, of him, of his pronunciation of Tobias Ludvigsson, which just faded off at the end when he gave up on pronouncing it. But obviously, he's a character as well, which is kind of what Eurosport's about. And I think ITV are trying to bring that in as well with the guests they bring in the middle of the stage. But obviously, Eurosport have been doing what they do for a long time, as well as they do, and they do it constantly throughout the year. But thinking about Sean Kelly and him being Mr. Paris Nice, are there any races that particularly stand out to you for personal reasons as ones you really enjoy commentating on, perhaps from your riding career, or just you enjoy the actual racing?
I can remember as a young boy, my introduction to watching TV, you know, Robert Miller, now Philip of York, used to join us in the training group, and I was 12, 13, and I'm going, who is that? It's Robert Miller, professional rider. What do you mean professional? What does he do? He raced, he gets paid to ride. I says, can you have such a thing as that? I can remember going to a cafe in Scotland during the summer, and then he'd look at the watch and it would go almost 12:30. We'd dive around the corner into the TV shop and ask the manager to turn all the TVs on to the Tour de France grandstand, where we get the whole week's racing in about 10 minutes. And that was my buzz. And then we raced down the roads back home. And when I first started, it was all about the Tour de France, because that's the only thing you really saw. And then live cycling started to happen with the Kellogg City Centre crits, which kind of motivated me. Seeing Sean Kelly, Phil Anderson, Alan Piper all coming to Glasgow and going up and watching them. And I can remember Sean Kelly falling off, and he never took a lap out. He got up, he chased and got back on. It's such amazing. I can remember Robert Miller in his polka dot jersey. The jersey you see behind me hanging up is, they're quite a few memories, the jerseys that I've been given. I've just not framed them all yet, but that's Daniel Tekle-Haminot's jersey from the podium. So I can remember Robert, he wasn't the best crit rider, but he came back to Glasgow Road and he was allowed a few laps off the front, and the atmosphere was electric. And but I think talking about the races I loved watching, you mentioned a couple of them at the start of the podcast with Flesh Wallon and Liège, Bastogne Liège. They were kind of classic, really tough, my kind of races. Also Lombardy at the end of the year. I think to a certain bit, you're talking about Milan-San Remo. And in fact, most of the monuments I could think of were a motivation, but we never always saw them on television. And sometimes we'd go to the club rooms and watch some of the old, you know, Paris-Roubaix and various other things. Like, you know, when I rode the Giro in 94, there was no Giro coverage. In fact, I think they're up at my mum's in Scotland. I've got 3 VHS. Don't know if you know what these things are. Tape, you know, VHS cassettes that I can't play anywhere. It shows the Giro on Italian TV, and you can see me a little bit on in that. But we never had the coverage, the wall-to-wall coverage that we've got now. But cycling has come a long way. It's got very commercial, and I think you can't really do anything now because everybody picks out everything. You know, it's good and bad, because a lot of the times that you went to, like I can remember going to Semana Catalana race, and then I got a phone call in the evening from one of my friends, the training group I used to ride for, and from Mallorca. They were over training Mallorca, and they were in a bar, and the race came on live, and they were watching it. All of a sudden, I'm riding at the front. And they were like shouting at the TV and getting all motivated by it. And they told me about it. And I just thought, well, everybody back home, all my friends and family, never get to see these races, but now they can. And it must be, I was in a different era altogether. And it must be really motivating to not even leave your house and seeing your son or your cousin or a relation or your friends, you know, on TV. So yeah, I watch a lot of cycling. That's, I think someone said they were talking to Sean, and you know, my name came up, and Sean said he watches a lot of cycling. And I, like when we're talking about my role with the Eurosport, I love analysing things. I don't just commentate on the races or watch the races that I commentate on. Every other race I watch, if I miss it, I catch up in it. If there's 2 races on the same day, whether it's a women's race, men's elite race, I'll watch it, both of them, either on TV or on a laptop. It's wall-to-wall coverage of cycling now, and I'll watch it all.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is everywhere. And actually, I was just thinking as well, because you obviously mentioned that cycling is growing, and last week Sean Kelly published an article on his website talking about perhaps riders are going too far to maintain weight, like whichever one of the Yates brothers it was being in such good form at the UAE Tour and stuff like that, meaning they're not getting any time off. And Sean wrote about how when he used to ride, having a bit of a beer belly was all right. He'd sit down and have a glass of wine, a bottle of beer. Do you think that's the direction cycling should be heading, a bit, take a step back almost from being this elite program, or do you think it is right to push athletes right to their limits?
Do you know what? Sean called me a couple of weeks ago. I was out on the bike and the phone rang and I had my pods in my ear and it went, Sean Kelly. Most times I would ignore it. But when it's Sean Kelly phoning you and there's a hill coming up that I have to put it into my little ring and the smallest gear to ride up, any excuse, Sean Kelly phoning, I stopped. And I was talking away to him, how are you? Just out of the blue. Yeah, they were more in a lockdown. He was doing a bit of his mountain bike, doing kind of circuits and things like that, trying to keep fit. Probably it's the first time in 50 years that he's pretty much redundant or retired, because he's normally working, whether it's been racing, whether it's been working in races. So for the classics, this is the first time in about 50 years he's not had to do anything. So he phoned me up and we were talking about it. And I was talking about, I went through at the start of the year a stress fracture from running. So talking about that, and there's a lot of kind of study, and I've been helped by Dr. Nicola Kay, who's been working with Anna Boniface, a runner as well, a physio. Through work with them, I've looked a lot about bone density. And we're talking about it on the phone, myself and Sean, with the fact that we never had any impact. We were not allowed to walk anywhere, not at least run. So we had no impact exercises. All the training in the winter was very relaxed. You took a bit of time off. You started on your bike again. It was just bike, bike, bike. So you had absolutely no impact. Sometimes you had to go on strict diets. Like I went through a phase with bulimia. So I had a pretty strict diet and maybe not a natural diet. So we're missing stuff from kind of having natural diets as well. So there's a lot of things that come into things. And Dr. Nicola Kay, she did a study with Ineos and the right, and she was shocked by the bone density of pretty much all the riders. And a lot of that comes down to having no impact exercises, having really bad diet. And when me and Sean were talking about it, I think that kind of sparked something in his head, that he would talk about something, he would talk about that. And I think it comes down to diet. When you see these riders, I can remember Andy Hampston, he's one of the first riders that used to ride, you know, the STI levers. He used to ride one, the normal one on the right-hand side, and just the normal just brake lever without the gear changing, just to try and lighten up the front of his bike. The Motorola team in 94, they had in the Tour de France, they went there, I think, for the first time with titanium bikes. So they were looking at different ways of lightening the bike. Then came in marginal gains with Team Sky. So they were looking at everything from diet. And even now, speaking to Nicholas Roach about when nutritionists come to teams, they change everybody's nutrition. And I think sometimes that's a bad thing, because I think what Sean's trying to get at and what I'm talking about now, the mentality of our sport, I think that's a huge thing. Very, very big thing in cycling. And the nutritionist came in and said, right, you have to eat this, this, and this. Not everybody likes it. Not everybody can get on with the same nutrition. So nowadays, with Team Sunweb, they've got their own specific things. So it's all as an individual. It's not done as a team, which I think is very important, because as an individual, you get to eat. Not everybody can eat a meal of 500 calories or 1,000 calories. Not everybody got up in the morning like I had to do and Sean had to do, where you get pasta and beefsteak in the morning. You know, you don't have to do that now. But there's a lot of scrutiny on diet and nutrition. But I'm a firm believer, and this is our conversation I was having with Sean, that everything in moderation, you have to be able to relax. And you can be the skinniest, the fastest, the fittest rider, but you don't always win. And if your mentality is not right, because you've had to, you know, watch this and watch that and not do this, then the mentality of cycling is a big factor in winning or losing, no matter what else you put into it. And I think that's what Sean in his article is trying to allude to, that it's not that bad that you can have a bit of a beer belly at the start of the year. You can enjoy yourself. You can relax. You can put a little bit of weight on. You don't have to worry about it. You know, you'll get there in the end. So it's balancing up that mentality and all the marginal gains you have to do to be at the top of your game.
Yeah. And obviously the other way that I was thinking in terms of where cycling goes forward, because obviously the riders take the most priority, but in terms of growing the sport internationally, obviously you were part of the first African team to qualify for the, or to get a wild card for the Tour de France, and then they went world tour. I'm not qualified to, as Barlow World were there first, but for MTN Quebec to get there and then become world tour. How important is it to spread cycling away from Europe, where it's typically always been? I know obviously we get the race in the Middle East now, and we have the Tour of California, and obviously there's the Chinese World Tour races. But where do you think they should be looking now?
Well, definitely South America, and that's grown. That's a grown region. Just talking about Barlow World, that team wasn't registered in Africa. So officially, MTN Quebec were the first African team to ride the Tour de France. But yeah, looking at Tour de Colombia and San Juan now, I think San Juan was the first race that, and I know that Lombardi, who I used to race with, the manager of Pirasagan, he was contracting a lot of teams to go over there, because you're talking about over a day to get there in Argentina, a long way to go, start of the year, but that's building. Colombia is huge. When you see the stuff online and the fans there, absolutely phenomenal. And, you know, even looking at the Tour of Rwanda is massive. But I think history, cycling has to change. If it wants to be globalised, it has to change. It's still European-centric. Nobody really wants to go to China to race, and I don't think China really gets cycling. That may take time. Looking at Africa is a huge continent, and they've got a few kind of small races. I'd love to see a big race in South Africa, because there's been some big ones there in the past. Not everybody's motivated about going all the way down under the start of the year. I think until we start to see, I think the only way that we'll globalise cycling is if we start to see other countries coming up. Like when I was pro, pretty much it was European based, with a few individuals from America, from Australia. But now the Australians have come over, so now cycling is a bit of a power there. The Americans came up with teams and riders, so they became a bit of a power. What we've seen in China, well, there's no World Tour team. There's no, you know, there's a couple of small teams. They have got some very good riders, some very good track riders, but the road cycling scene doesn't seem to be kind of taking off there. Although they've got some kind of decent enough races. And then we look at Africa. I know there was a Tour of Africa in the past that lasted, one or two, maybe 3 years. But now we're starting to see a resurgence in South America with the Tour of Colombia, San Juan. But it needs teams to come out of there. It needs injection of money and funds. And maybe now, with what's happening now with the lockdown, the coronavirus, and some of the teams maybe I don't know what's going to happen for the rest of the year, whether we're going to see some racing or not. Maybe this is the time to kind of change cycling, to maybe invest in cycling if you're in a particular country. We might see teams folding because sponsors being unhappy during this time. They're not getting a return and big investments. And if we lose a few teams, which will be a pity, but if we gain some other teams from other parts of the world, I think that's the only way that we're going to globalise our sports, because it still is very much European-centric. But the other countries that we're talking about to be able to grow, it's not about just taking races there. We have to develop from grassroots all the way up to the top. And I know that when I was a young rider, I had Robert Miller to look up to. Well, if you're in a small village in a different part of the world, who's your peer? Who do you look up to? And I think anybody that's involved with cycling has to have something that motivates them. And a lot of the parts of the world, there might not be interest in cycling. There might not be teams. There might not be any grassroots stuff. Some of the smaller countries might not even be able to have, you know, bikes to be able to use. But I really think that working with an African team, there's huge potential in Africa. There might not be the funds, but there's huge potential. If these African runners can run, they can cycle. And that's what I used to, you know, I loved working with the MTN Quebec team and Dimension Data. I loved working with Daniel Tekel and Haminot, Mahawi Kudus, these type of riders, because Eritrea has got 5 million people, roughly the same size as Scotland. But when Daniel went back home with the King of the Mountains jersey, he hadn't won it. He just wore it for a few days. He was a national hero. And the amount of fans, the amount of people that understood cycling was phenomenal. And I think there's still a lot of huge talent in Africa. And when we look at our sport, you know, can you tell me how many black African riders are in the current peloton? When you look at running, you look at how many black Africans are fantastic runners, especially, you know, endurance sport. And we are an endurance sport. But I just think what's holding possibly the Africans back is the money, the economy. But certainly, you can see the economy building. It might not be a huge economy in South Africa, but it looks as if they're starting, not in South Africa, South America, they're starting to get behind the races. And when you look at the Tour of Colombia and the people that are going out supporting that race, it just needs an injection of cash. And I think with the worldwide COVID-19 problem, there might be a lot of companies really suffering, but it might give them an opportunity once we get out the other side to maybe look at something a bit different. And hopefully they'll look at cycling, inject a bit into maybe the grassroots and start to build. But I know from working in cycling all my life with either Scottish cycling or British cycling, it's not about these so-called kind of federations. It's not about British cycling or Scottish cycling. It's about the volunteers. The volunteers that go out every weekend, the clubs, you know, they're the people that we should be supporting. They're the people that entice young riders to get on the bike and they support them. And then all Scottish cycling or British cycling, whatever country you're in, they just take the cream from the top. What we need to do is get below that and support these volunteers, because without these volunteers, we wouldn't possibly have recognised some of the talents that we've had through British cycling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you said, certainly a lot of potential in Africa. Eritrea obviously proving himself to be fairly strong. Ethiopia have had a few riders up there. South Africa, again, put a few out. And like, I think the races they have got do just need that extra push, whether or not that's financial incentives for riders to go out there like it sometimes has to be or what, I don't know, but I think there's certainly a lot of potential. And the other thing is those riders that do come through from Africa, like all the riders who were at MTN, the one like Tekla Hymenot when he was at Orica and stuff like that, they all seem to be absolutely loved by all the people they work with, which is what the sport needs.
Do you know what, Will? They are lovely, lovely people. And, you know, they're coming into a very much, I would say, white-based sport in cycling as a black rider. And it's very difficult for them to kind of try and fit in. And I can remember meeting them for the first time and giving them a hug. And do you know the biggest thing that came from our meeting and talking to these riders? They all said to me the reason why they did what they did, and they were the same riders that the years before, is because I wanted to understand about them, about their culture, and I believed in them and I gave them confidence. That was it. That's all they needed. Because I can remember as a Scottish rider going to France and riding for ACBB and sitting down for dinner, and a lot of the bike riders would get a baguette. They would take out the centre piece of the baguette because it was all kind of gooey, roll it up in a ball. And I would get, you know, small bits of bread thrown at me. And because I couldn't speak the language at that time, they would be taking the mickey out. They'd be telling me things to say to go and say to the manager, which I can't repeat. So we were the kind of laughing stock. And as you, as an individual in our sport, it can be quite cruel at times. And for a lot of these black Africans, this sport can be quite cruel. In fact, in the Vuelta, when they first rode, they were getting a bit of abuse. I'd say it would be racial abuse. And Chris Froome overheard it. And Chris Froome went up to the riders that were telling them, just get to the back, get away from the front, stop interfering. He went up to these individuals and told them off, which I think is great. So I think more and more we're starting to see, you know, riders from different countries coming through. And in my era, it was all European. Now you could say it's starting to build. And I think I could count in one hand how many Australians were riding, how many American riders were riding. So I think a lot of different countries are building. I think one of the biggest countries that are building at the moment, I've mentioned them from South Africa, Colombia, is really, really building with it, with its talents. But I think the UCI have to really support these countries. Maybe it's an education. You know, what we'll see from MTN Quebec, especially the Quebec charity, giving bikes to the students down there to go to school. Hopefully one day one of these students riding that bike instead of walking or running might use that bike to become a cyclist in the future. I really hope that that happens and it's traced all the way through. But I think a lot of countries have to look at their own, and nobody has the funding. When you consider that we get questions at the World Championships about why they're doing this and why they're doing that, a lot of the times, a lot of these federations are not wearing the same kit, don't have, you know, turn up at the dinner table all in different team kit, and they don't look uniform or anything like that. It's because although they ride for a big team, a big pro team or something like that, but the federation doesn't have money. The federation cannot give them, you know, the same helmets, the same clothing, and that's why they all look different. So, yeah, there's not a lot of money in the basics of cycling. It's all up at the top. And I think the UCI really have to, instead of fighting with the likes of Velon and spending money in lawsuits and things like that, really have to kind of support these federations, try and help them bring some money in, supporting other teams, supporting smaller teams, and look at the, you know, pretty much the economy of cycling in general if they want to make it global.
Yeah, and one thing that popped into my head there when you said about obviously the riders at the Vuelta is the only thing that I think stands out to me that's picked up massively on the media that potentially will put off riders like that coming through is riders like, I don't mean to single him out, but he doesn't help himself particularly. People like Gianni Moscon, who seem to go week after week with another incident about something. He's had a racial incident. He's then caused crashes deliberately. He's then got disqualified recently and compounded that with then littering all his gel package and stuff. And riders like that don't exactly put the best light on upcoming nations to want to invest in a sport like that.
Do you know what? Maybe off the bike, Gianni Moscon is a really nice guy. But on the bike, he is not a nice guy. And, you know, we can look at other sports and look at individuals. And it's not a popularity contest. Moscon is a quality rider. But when everybody, I've got a son who plays football, gets very frustrated and lashes out. And that's what he's doing. It's maybe, dare I say it, a bit of immaturity. Nowadays in cycling, there's cameras everywhere and you get picked up and everything. You can't throw your bike in someone. You can't punch someone. And how many lives is he going to have? And okay, I'm totally against racism, but you know, when you open your mouth and at the heat of the moment, when you make a rash reaction in the heat of the moment, some people just are not built that way. I know from my son, he lashes out, and that hopefully something that will go away with maturity. But there's a lot of young riders that's very difficult when you're growing up to show discipline. And that's what I do with my two young boys. I talk to them all the time. If you want to do sports, about discipline. If you want to do anything in life, it's about discipline. I would say Gianni Moscon has discipline. He's a quality bike rider, but he does have some issues. And I think he needs some help. Well, I'm not saying he thinks he needs help. He definitely needs help. And that's probably seen some sort of a therapist or something, because he just sees red. And as much as he's a nice guy and talented bike rider, he cannot do that in sport anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hopefully moving forward, because of the talent he has, and obviously his Palmeiras, looking back at his career, is pretty incredible. So hopefully Ineos can get that under control and get him pushing on to be a better rider. I think, looking at the time, that's going to be everything. So thanks for joining me. It's been a pleasure to speak to you and get all this insight.
What have we done? 10 minutes? 15 minutes?
50.
Almost. Well, as you know, I can talk. I do it for a living. So, yeah, I can talk for another hour if you want, but probably the viewers will go to sleep.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll get Carlton Kirby on. He'll have telltale stories for hours. That's what he does. Yeah,
exactly.
You put on exactly. The cycling at 12 o'clock on a Tour de France stage, you know you've got just 2 hours of story time before you actually have to watch any cycling. So it's all good. It's all good.
Well, I tell Carlton Kirby, I says, make sure you go on and talk. If I'm not on the race, make sure you go on between maybe 1 and 2 so I can have a wee nap.
Yeah, no. But everyone loves him. So it's all good. That's what we want to see.
Yeah, so thank you for joining me.
I'm not sure who I'll be back with next time. I think it will be Gabby Homer, the Irish cyclist. So I'll see you then.